This is Terrence McNally. This week I'm going to share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with Sherry Turkle, director of MIT's Initiative on Technology and the Self, and the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. This interview originally aired in February 2011. How much technology do you use? Email, texting, Facebook, Twitter, Second Life, robot pets, and on and on. Now I ask you, how's it working for you? Has it freed you up, given you more time, or has it added new demands to your life that actually make you feel you have less time? If you're using social media regularly, do you feel more connected with your friends and family or less? And to kids or parents out there, do you have enough moments of full attention with each other? Today's guest, clinical psychologist Sherry Turkle, is the founder and director of the MIT Initiative in Technology and Self. She's been studying that relationship for most of her career and has written several books about what she's experienced and learned. Of her newest, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, she has said, "This is a book of repentance. I have been studying computers and people for 30 years. I didn't see several important things. I got some important things wrong. I was already interested in talking to her, but that really grabbed my attention. I'm interested in people, especially experts, who are willing to change their minds." Turkle writes, "Technology promises to let us do anything from anywhere with anyone, but it also drains us as we try to do everything everywhere. We begin to feel overwhelmed and depleted by the lives technology makes possible. We may be free to work from anywhere, but we are also prone to being lonely everywhere. In a surprising twist, relentless connection leads to a new solitude. We turn to new technology to fill the void, but as technology ramps up, our emotional lives ramp down." On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Sherry Turkle is professor of social studies of science and technology in the program in Science, Technology, and Society at MIT, and the founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. She received a joint doctorate in sociology and personality psychology from Harvard and is a licensed clinical psychologist. She's the author of several books, including The Second Self, Computers and the Human Spirit, and Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet, and her newest, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Welcome, Sherry Turkle, to Free Forum.
It's a pleasure to be here, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So you studied sociology and personality psychology. How is it that you began to focus on the relationships between humans and technology? And were there particular experiences or people that led you in that direction?
Yes, I took a job, my first job coming out of Harvard as somebody trained really as a clinician and a social scientist. I took a job at MIT because my first book had been called Psychoanalytic Politics. It was about why France had not been interested in psychoanalytic ideas and then why all of a sudden in the post-68 years in the early 70s there had been a kind of infatuation with Freudian ideas in France. And MIT had seemed to me a perfect place to look at a new kind of idea that was now sort of hitting the streets, which was ideas about the mind that was based on computation.
And what year this is?
This was like 76, 77. Because, you know, there had always been artificial intelligence and ideas about computers, but in 76, 77, 78, those ideas were sort of now filtering out because people now for the first time had home computers or were having experiences with computers that made those ideas more compelling, more real to people. They weren't abstract. And so I was able to study the same kind of problem, psychoanalytic ideas, you know, that had been very sort of for experts. And then all of a sudden, you know, psychoanalytic ideas became ideas that helped you raise children or ideas that you, you know, talked about with your friends. People analyzed each other's dreams. I mean, how does something like that happen? And I tried to study that same kind of movement of ideas about computers from seminar rooms and into the popular culture. But then, as I was studying this pretty academic problem, something dramatic happened. It was like my first, I don't know, it happened in my first couple of weeks at MIT that I noticed the intensity of people's relationships with their computers.
And you'd never seen that before?
Never. I mean, no. I'd gone to Harvard. I didn't see people with computers. People used to go to the, you know, computer lab, I don't know, the computer building to, to put in their punch cards or whatever they did in the computer building. I, you know, when I wanted to run data, I had a friend who did that kind of thing, and I would give him the data and he would put in the punch card. I mean, I never saw people in relationship
right
to this technology. I saw people kind of using it to do kind of instrumental things.
So it was partly the fact that you were in a place that was ahead.
Yes.
And that you were where they were.
Yes. And these were people who were actually working with, in, on and these computers. And also that first early generation of personal computers was starting to come out. The computers that you could build from kits, the Altair, the first, you know, the first generation of TRS-80 home computers. I mean, let me tell you, when I saw people with computers, I can barely speak because I mean I could at the time it hit me like that.
And when you say when I saw people with computers, you mean
were with computers. I mean, you know, people say, oh, it was just like stereo, which is like they're with their cars. No. No. It was not like that. I'd seen people with their cars. I'd seen people with their stereos. Not like that. And the reason for this, I think, is that the computer is a mind machine. It really is a machine that, that it doesn't have its own psychology, but in a way it presents itself as though it does. I think that is why I called my first book on this question The Second Self. It's that I took that name from a young woman, a 13-year-old girl, who had a little personal computer on which she programmed, and she said, when you program a computer, you take a little piece of your mind and you put it in the computer's mind, and you come to see it differently. And it was that mind-to-mind connection with the technology that fascinated me. Literally, you know, I'd come to MIT to do one thing. I met this phenomena, and I would say that it was the beginning of a new career for me.
Yeah. I'm really glad I asked the question.
Well, it is. I mean, I gave a long answer to a short question, but that is the truth.
Yeah. And what it also does, I think, for people is reminds them of a time. You know, I can remember actually, I think it might have been, I've been in California since 75. So this might have been 74, might have been 73. I made a friendship with someone who was at MIT. And I was doing video documentary at the time with the first Portapacks.
Yeah.
You know. And he was saying how he was working in a lab at MIT where they were creating images on the screen that had never existed as physical reality.
Wow.
Right? In other words, yeah. You know, I thought, okay, you do a photo, you take a – no, they were putting – and I can at this moment remember sitting on the bank of the Charles and him telling me that and me going, you know, just sort of what is that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Sherry Turkle, psychologist, professor, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, and author of several books. And we're talking about her newest, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And you can learn more by going to Alone Together Book, one word, alonetogetherbook.com. My second question was, when did you realize this was going to remain the focus of your work for the rest of your life? Or, I mean, for the rest of your life to this point. I mean, this is going to be your career. We're talking about, you know, 30 years you've been at this.
It has been 30 years. I've been at this 30 years.
So I didn't mean to doom you.
Yeah,
I just meant
right.
I mean, was there a moment when you said, wow, this isn't one thing I'm dealing with for a couple of years. This is the trenches I'm in.
Well, I wrote The Second Self from the day I hit MIT to 1984 when the book came out. And by the time I wrote The Second Self, I realized that I had found my next subject, which was the subject of I've been very fortunate in that the technology has been moving. And as the technology has been developing, it has posed new challenges. My subject is the same. Let me just roll back a second. My subject is not what computers do for us, but what computers do to us. to our sense of self, to the ways we raise our children, to how we see the world. I call it the subjective computer. And what's kept my subject changing is that as the technology has evolved, it has posed that question in very different ways. So those first computers that my students were falling in love with and projecting themselves onto and seeing as a second self, those first computers were there as objects to be programmed, as objects to be projected onto. And I studied in that first book, Second Self, the projection of self onto machine. And I studied the one-on-one, that fascinating one-on-one connection of self and machine. By 1985, 1986, you could already see that people were moving online into this new world of the internet, then called the ARPANET. And I began to be fascinated by the issues of online connectivity. And that is the subject of the second book, which I was able to trace that story from very early. That book is called Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet. And that story takes you from what kind of life do we have when we step over the port, use the computer as a portal to a virtual life beyond it, to a life beyond the screen, in the sense, to the life that we share with other people on the network beyond the screen. So I was able to tell the story of the very early AOL, the chat rooms, the early MUDs and MOOs, which were the multi-user domains that are the sort of early versions of something like Second Life and Virtual Worlds. And that was the subject of my second book. So it was the which posed very different questions and psychological issues.
It's interesting to me also that your degree was in sociology and psychology, because now you're moving into...
Exactly. I was well trained. I mean, I'm blessed, because it turned out that I was very well trained to study this phenomenon that I actually think does require the training of a kind of a sociologist and psychologist to kind of capture or begin to capture what's going on, because I'm able to do what I call an intimate ethnography. You know, that is to say, I do an ethnography, I look at the social environment, but I also do sit for many hours, you know, doing interviews to try to figure out, well, what is the meaning going on here? What is the meaning of this technology to people? But that second book was not about the one-on-one with a computer. It was about the world that we shape with each other as we meet each other in the virtual places that we get to through the computer. And one of the things that fascinated me most in that book was the identity play that's possible when people go online and play out aspects of themselves, whether in a game or in a virtual world or in a virtual community that isn't fully realized in their physical life.
Right.
And whether it's adolescents or whether it's older people, you create an avatar, but you end up playing some aspect of yourself. And I traced that through, you know, hundreds of cases and found that a very compelling story.
And this is the world of the internet, but it's prior to social media and prior to online dating and all those things.
Absolutely. This was 1995.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were asking me about why I consider Alone Together a Book of Repentance, is that there was something I didn't see in 1995. I saw it. If you read the book carefully, when I went back and I read the book carefully, because when I say I didn't see it, I saw it a little bit, but I didn't focus on it. And what I didn't see is how this would change when you had your technology always on and always on you. My model, and I joke to my students, I say, call me not prescient, you know. I say that my model of how this identity exploration would take place was that people were at work and they'd have several windows open on their screen, and they would cycle through, I coined this term, cycling through different identities, that they would experiment and explore the identities that were on their screen. And that was fascinating to me, this notion of multiple identities and cycling through. Or they would be at work during the day and with their kids and so forth. And then at night, they would spend several hours, often many hours, 3, 4, 5 hours, in online worlds, exploring different aspects of self. But basically, I saw a firewall of sorts
that when you weren't at your computer, you weren't with your computer.
Yes. Yes. And of course, I'm exaggerating slightly because, you know, I really was interested in the fluidity of that boundary psychologically. But essentially, you put it, could you say that again? Because that's exactly what I thought. You know,
that when you weren't at your computer, you weren't with your computer.
Well put. Well put, Terrence. Exactly. And after I finished Life on the Screen, I had a profound experience of going back to MIT and teaching again and meeting Steve Mann, Thad Starner, who were scientists at MIT who called themselves cyborgs.
Already. 95, 96.
95, 96. And these were a group of young scientists who were wearing their computers as backpacks, who carried their keyboards in their pockets, who wore their glasses were screens, and who essentially were wearing the web on their backs. So, I mean, I'm forgetting I learned of them and their early experiments. They'd be there for a while. Steve Mann has been at this a very long time. But essentially, I saw what I had missed.
Right.
And I saw the future. People were making fun of them at the time. People were saying, oh, my God, they look like disabled people. People were always, you know, thinking that they had some kind of prosthetic because these were like, you know, artificial lungs or, you know, people – I mean, they were
– Well, when you say you saw the future, did you in a sense – because obviously what made it work for the masses and not just for the cutting-edge eccentrics was the reduction in size, among other things.
I knew.
But you did.
I knew. I mean, I didn't know. I knew. I mean, I, you know, I couldn't know. But I decided for both the story of mobile communication and for the story of sociable robotics, because I also had a very aha moment meeting my first sociable robot. So a sociable robot was called – the sociable robot is called COG. And sociable robots are robots that essentially engage you in a sociable interaction. They're not robots that are – you know, they're there to be with you, to be companions.
They're not manufacturing a car.
No, they're not manufacturing anything. They're not cleaning the rug or cleaning the dishes or cleaning. I love those robots. And these are robots that are there to be with you.
And this is back in.
I think this was 1996 or 1997. I was at a conference on artificial life with Christopher Langton, who was a great figure in the history of artificial life, and. We go together to Rodney Brooks's laboratory. No, it had to be in 1995 because I include this anecdote in Life on the Screen. I got it into the galleys for Life on the Screen.
Right.
So it has to be before – it has to be 1995. And I remember telling – you know, really annoying everybody at the publisher saying, I have to put this anecdote in. So the book is in – you know, it's done. No. I remember putting it at the very end. So that's in 1995. And – here's this robot that looks you in the eye, can recognize a face, and it can recognize eyes. So it's looking you in the eye, it gestures in your direction, and it tracks human motion because it can tell what's human motion and what's – because human motion is motion that's irregular. Non-human motion is very linear. And it fixes on you, usually because you're wearing a color that it's been programmed to be interested in. It could be red, it could be blue, and it tracks on you. And I became competitive with Christopher Langton about who COG was paying more attention to. And it turns out that when a robot looks you in the eye, gestures in your direction, makes eye contact, tracks your motion, you're toast. You believe that there is someone home because the last thing biologically in a Darwinian sense that ever did that was another human being. And so we are very vulnerable to a robot that does those things to us.
Well, I'm asking mirror neurons?
Absolutely.
At play?
Yes.
In here? And for those of you that's a new concept toward, I had Antonio Damasio on a few weeks ago. I'm going to keep dealing with this. I find this a very interesting cutting edge. But if you can tell people what the role of a mirror neuron is, and although the robot doesn't have it, our mirror neurons doesn't know the robot doesn't have it.
Yes. I mean, mirror neurons, as you anticipate, I mean, where I think would be relevant is that you anticipate the actions.
No, here's what I get, because I've been working with this lately, is that when I see you rub your arm, it fires in my brain the same things that would happen if I were rubbing my arm.
Yes, so that you're anticipating that if the robot is looking as though it cares, you feel
the same thing you would if a person did it.
Yes. So anyway, this relationship forms. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at, is that you anticipate that there's a relationship. This is what part of what makes you toast. I mean, you anticipate a relationship, whereas in fact, there's no relationship. And I decided to follow that story as well. And in my mind, the two have turned out to be quite related.
Now, let me just say, so when she says she followed the two of them, the book Alone Together has an introductory sort of section that sets it up, and then it splits into two sections.
Yeah.
And the first section is on robotics and sociable robotics. The second section is on the all-the-time, all-connected world that many of us live in. I thought that was an interesting thing because I don't think about robotics much. I mean, you know.
Time to think, Terrence.
If I could read my questions, that's exactly where I go. I say, should I? Should we be? But I haven't been, right? Whereas the other one, the social media, the texting, all that stuff, that's in my world. That's it. And the robots is sort of, but you, from your perspective, you see them both. When you say time to think about what is happening with robotics, what robotics means, are you saying because within just a few years or what's your perspective on that?
Well, my perspective is that we didn't think before we put mobile connectivity in our lives. We just said, oh, phones will interrupt us every few minutes. Cool. You know, texts that we'll be texting at funerals, you know, whoa. You know, I mean, we put a seductive technology into the hands of our 8-year-olds and we haven't given it a thought. I'm exaggerating here, of course, and really I apologize to all of my colleagues who've been writing up storms, giving this many thoughts. But essentially, as a culture, we've put ourselves in a position where Mark Zuckerberg can say privacy as a social norm is no longer relevant. And actually, there are a lot of people who don't blink an eye when he says that.
And the younger they are, the more they seem to.
Because
they've grown up in it.
We've given them a technology where actually when the social network doesn't find it convenient to have privacy, we sort of think, okay, social network, you don't want privacy, maybe we won't have it either. So, but we did this really, I think, without having the kind of conversation.
It was a step at a time. If possible, let's try it. If possible and it sells, then definitely try more of it.
Yes. And so the second part of the book is to say, listen, we've been doing this, and I think, given my tracing this over 15 years, it's time to take a beat and step back and say, I think we've gotten ourselves into some places where we're not serving our human purposes.
Right.
So let's reconsider.
We will shift.
We will go to there. But the reason I put the sociable robots first.
And I thought that was a calculated thing.
Calculated.
Otherwise, people would have read the part that affected them and maybe skipped the other part.
I put the sociable robot first because I say, here's a technology that's very big in Japan. So, I mean, I can, you know, it's not like this is the technology that, you know.
It isn't the future.
It isn't the future. It's happening now. It's every Danish nursing home has a sociable robot. It's being now aggressively marketed here. You're going to be seeing more of it in the years to come. There's already a discourse about why we need it. There's already conferences and, you know, it's out there. It's not kind of distant, but it's not like in your face yet. And let's think first. And here are some tools for thinking about it because let's think first. Here's another seductive technology and let's think first.
So we can think about it first. Briefly, you referred quickly, Japan. Scandinavia, the arguments for it. What is, for those people who have not been looking at it, what's going on?
Well, it's the premise is that there aren't really enough people to take care of the elderly. You know, the boomers are aging and the next demographic group coming in, there aren't as many of them. There aren't enough young to take care of the old. Taking care of the old is very expensive. And robots can be brought in to do the job, like calling in the cavalry. And they can be companions to the elderly in addition to doing some very common sense things like helping out with medicine and making sure that, you know, if the elderly fall, they can lift them up and stuff like this. Now, I'm all for the robots. I mean, just get clear. I'm all for the robots that help with anything instrumental. you know, robots that are in a home and make sure that if a elderly person has fallen, are there to, you know, are in a position that they shouldn't be, you know, someone's on the floor for too long a time, that they sense that, they make a call. I'm for anything that helps with anything practical. But having introduced, you know, in my research, having introduced robots that pretend to be companions.
And they're designed to pretend to be companions.
Yes, that's what these sociable robots do. That's what they're...
By the look, by the turn of the head, by the body language.
And by the voice. They have vocabularies and they increasingly pretend to understand. Having an old woman explain the loss of a husband, the death of a child, to an inanimate object that is pretending to understand, that doesn't know what it is to have a husband or doesn't know what it is to lose a child, that doesn't know what it is to have an elderly person talk about their divorce and how they're sorry and how they feel regret to an object that could have no understand of human regret. I call these chapters Love's Labor Lost.
Right. And the robot is responding in ways that simulate understanding and empathy because they're responding to behavioral signals.
Yes.
As the elderly moves their head a certain way and their tone of voice a certain way and their eyes do certain things.
Yes.
It's programmed to respond. Yeah.
Yes. And these robots are getting better and better and better. And even as we speak, are getting better. And I have incredible, incredible wonder at the ingenuity of my colleagues who are creating robots that become better and better at picking up on ever finer
signals
from the humans that they're dealing with. And my question is, why would we want to do this? Why would we want to do this?
Yeah.
And I think that I want to be part of that conversation. I want to start that conversation. I think that time to have it.
And I would say that in the in research for this interview, I looked at interviews, whether in print or radio, television, so on, that you've done. And in some sense, you are.
Good.
Starting that conversation because I haven't heard it much. You know, I mean, we saw Blade Runner, but we haven't talked about things very seriously. When you ask people who are the folks who are designing these, if when you are in your 80s and you are being cared for by a robot, is that, you know, do you get what I'm saying? How do they think it will actually be comforting?
The best possible answer to me. So I think it's always good when somebody knows the best rebuttal to their argument.
Yeah.
I think that's a very, very good point. The best answer to me is to say we have relationships with many, many different kinds of things, creatures and beings. Right now, we do dogs, we do cats, and we do horses, and we know that they have certain things they can do and can't do, and we will add to that list robots, and we will come to learn what they can do and cannot do, and no harm, no foul.
And I guess what they're saying is there obviously has been a movement over the last 5 or 10 years of dogs for the elderly, pets for the... I mean, this is something which we didn't hear much about, and now we've heard about.
But I have a good answer to them.
Well, yeah, so theirs is. Thus, this just gives us a wider repertoire.
Yep.
And your answer.
That puts it very well. Their response is, this is just a wider repertoire comment, move. And with the research I report on Alone Together, I think undermines that response, because we are vulnerable, in a way, to these objects that we need to take into account, just as we're vulnerable to our cell phones in a way that we need to take into account. Let me just back up and say what I mean by that. I interview many mothers, 100 mothers, who talk about driving on the highway at 65, if they think they're going the speed limit, sometimes 80 miles an hour when they admit to driving too fast, having the BlackBerry on the seat beside them, the little red light goes off, and they're texting on the highway or answering email on the highway with their kids in the car. Now, are these mothers happy that they're endangering their lives and those of their children? No. But they are vulnerable to doing something that they know is not really in their best interest. And as a therapist, I know that when you're vulnerable, the best way to move on is to admit your vulnerability, not beat yourself for it, and try to find a way to analyze the vulnerability.
And not let it get you in danger.
Yes, and then pull up your socks and try to do better for you and your family. Similarly with the robots, I've done study after study where you explain to the person that this is a robot. You explain to the person that this robot doesn't understand what you're saying. You explain to the person, as a matter of fact, in the study I did with Cynthia Brazil and Brian Scazzolatti, two colleagues at MIT who developed very sophisticated sociable robots, we unrobotized the robot to turn it. It was like taking Pinocchio and making him turn back into a puppet after being a real boy. We turned the robot back into being a puppet. We took out all of the artificial intelligence to show children that it really was nothing. Just a program, and then we sort of reprogrammed it to make this point that really it was only a robot. The minute that robot looks you in the eye, does the gesture of affection, people are...
Seems interested, seems to care.
Seems to care. We are enchanted once again. As a matter of fact, if you look at I forget the exact Plato quote, but I begin the book with an inscription from Plato, "Everything that deceives may be said to enchant." Or maybe it's the other way.
Everything that deceives may be said to enchant. Plato and the Republic.
Right. And what I love about that quote is I always forget if it's the – because it also works the other way. Everything that enchants may be said to deceive.
Oh, that's a little more pessimistic. But, let me tell people. I'm Terrence McNally. We're about at the halfway point here. I'm speaking with Sherry Turkle. She's a psychologist, a professor, director of the MIT Initiative on Technology. She's been at and Technology and Self. She's been at MIT for 30 years, and she is really one of the first and certainly one of the premier people who has looked at our relationships, with our social and psychological relationships with the machines that we have those with, which is computers, robots, cell phones, etc. Her new book is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And you can learn more about her work at alonetogetherbook.com. Okay. Let me see. I want to move on from the robots, but I must say
Just want to get back to this point. So the reason I say that this is my best response to people who just say, okay, what's the harm? You know, give them a robot. We'll just put on the fine print on the, you know, explanation that, you know, it's only a robot. It doesn't really understand. Is that we are more vulnerable than that. That's like saying, you know, don't text on the highway. You know, it's really not a good idea. It doesn't take seriously
our vulnerability.
And this book is really about taking seriously our vulnerability. And the leitmotif, the theme through Alone Together is human vulnerability, technological affordance. Technology is offering us, in the area of robotics and in the area of connectivity, things that we are vulnerable to, and we have to have a better response than a shrug.
Right. And I remember there was a line that I'm looking for because I was going to read it back to you, and it very much is that one that it's about the vulnerabilities. And you say, you know, that these machines can respond to or connect with our vulnerabilities, and boy, are we vulnerable. Mm-hmm. What I was going to say is that as I was listening to you, and that woman, that mother is driving, and the red light goes on, and she knows she has a message, and so on, is, I'm telling you, the thought that came into my head was, she's like a machine, that she can't resist it. And it was weird because I realized, wait, no, that's the wrong thing. She's the human in this equation. But do you get what I'm saying? That in our vulnerabilities, there's an automaticity that we would hope to think we are the humans. We don't just see the red light and react. We're able to, you know, right. We're in charge. And yet we wouldn't be nearly so vulnerable if we were in charge. And it's sort of machine-like to me in the way that we're not.
Well, we actually talk to people about why they respond. It turns out to be terribly complicated. And I think complicated in ways that give me some reason for hope.
Good.
For example, people talk about their phone as the place for hope in their life, as the place where new things come to them. It reminds me of, you know, the place where sweet things will come to them. You know, you know, I'm an author. That's where I look for my Amazon numbers, you know, well, my book is doing, you know, or everybody's waiting for a message from someone they love or care about, you know, the text
right.
from.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm going through my life and my day and it's boring. Yeah, and
something new will come or someone you care about will be in touch or something new or some, you know, that invitation or that thing that will just make next week light up or that. You know, that friend you've lost track of or that article that you so it always reminded me of Jane Austen and you know how the families in Jane Austen would listen for Mr. Bingley's the post, and there'd be an invitation from Mr. Bingley and, you know, the ball and the hope that there
right,
would be
right,
the social
right.
invitation that would change your life.
What's so funny, of course, about that is that it might come. You would expect it once a month, if at all. And
yeah,
now it's
instantly.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, I think that, you know, I remember, you know, people talk about, it reminds me of Jay Beresford Tipton and The Millionaire, that show we grew up with, you know, that he would come and hand you a check for $1 million or the publisher's clearinghouse would come
yeah,
in the,
yeah.
I mean, something that would change. And I think that our transference, which is a psychoanalytic word that means our connection, our profound connection to these phones, is that they have become the place where we look to for all of that.
And you're certainly talking now. I realize when you first said the word phone, I thought you meant phone. You mean the smartphones,
the
where
smartphone.
You not only get
yes.
the call, the text,
yes.
but it's where if your stock went up, if your ball team
yes.
won.
It's all there. Or it's your email. I mean, for some
yeah.
people,
yeah.
this is what – when that thing pings – they're gone. I mean, you're in a conversation with somebody in their office and there's a ping on their email. Literally, they turn, you know, they don't even say, excuse me anymore. I mean, they're gone. So I think that on the one hand, there's certainly a lot of research that talks about that we reward ourselves for their brain rewards us for multitasking by giving a shot of neurochemicals whenever we start a new task. Our brain rewards us for multitasking, and even as our performance in every task degrades as we multitask, we don't care. We feel like masters of the universe because our brain is rewarding us for multitasking. We didn't even notice that our performance is
doing it. Yeah.
But, you know, everybody who's ever had to finish a project, finish a book, you know, an artist who's had to finish a painting knows that when the crunch comes, you have to turn it all off because you have to finish. So.
Oh, that's me.
Oh.
Oh, that couldn't be funnier. I've never had that happen.
Terrence's phone is ringing.
I know.
But perhaps he did that to be witty.
I wish. That's very. I mean, the timing was
the
so
timing.
Perfect.
Well, it stopped, Terrence.
I know, but
I can handle it.
It may happen again. Continue.
And if it does.
Yes. That was amazing.
The timing was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the point being that what just happened between us is kind of the story of our lives now. The difference is that Terrence got all beat red in the face and got very flustered and embarrassed. But in regular life, at dinner.
Yeah.
People like say, excuse me, and they answer it.
I think that is just amazing. I truly.
But your readers are going to think you set that up.
I know.
Your listeners are going to think
readers,
you set
it up. Yeah. Sorry, guys. That was. I wish I were that clever where I'd had it just at that moment that you said
right.
it goes off and
yeah.
everything changes.
Right.
But I will tell you that this is one interview where I will not edit it out.
I think it makes the
yeah,
point. But
exactly.
essentially, you know, one of the arguments I make in Alone Together when we get to the connectivity section is that we're too busy communicating to think. We're too busy communicating to connect. And sometimes we're too busy communicating to create. And that this is true for individuals and it's also true for organizations. And what's with that?
Yeah. Before we – I mean, I definitely, you know, keep saying I want to get out of the robot world and so on. But I do want to ask you about two people who write about this. Ray Kurzweil, obviously his three books I'm thinking of are The Age of Intelligent Machines, then The Age of Spiritual Machines, and finally The Singularity is Near. And he's the one who agreed with those people when they said they were cyborgs, and so on. And then Kevin Kelly's new book, What Does Technology Want? Just a little bit of your response to what both of them are saying.
Both of these men's work is of tremendous interest to me. I mean, I think that what Ray is tapping is the idea, the singularity for your listeners who might not know, is that moment where artificial intelligence becomes so smart that all of our assumptions about intelligence and mind and just go out the window, totally out the window, because it can now do things and make things and be things and give us things that we cannot even imagine. It's kind of like the rapture. It's kind of like in Alone Together, I call it the technological rapture, where all assumptions change, where all bets are off. And Ray thinks that one of the things that's going to happen at that moment is that machines will, in a sense, you know, we will be able to live forever because we will become in a way one with the machine. We will.
The book, I haven't read The Singularity Is Near yet, but The Age of Spiritual Machines is a phenomenal book in that while he's telling the story of what technology is doing and can do, he has a second thing going on there where he has a person at the end of each chapter writing to him in a way from the future. And she is experiencing these transformations. And when you said we will become as one, you basically, you know, yes, maybe this corporal body will die, but by then you will have downloaded your personality and your brain, everything that all your information will have been downloaded into something else that doesn't die.
Yes. So the notion is it's a way of not dying because we will continue to live in a form in which we become a machine. I mean, we become cyborg, we become one with the machine becomes us. I mean, the issue of an us and them disappears in his way of thinking. Now, whether you some people think it's going to be because we download onto the machine, or whether it's because we just continue to incorporate machine parts into us as, you know, enough prosthetics. And then finally, you don't know if you're a robot or where does the line end? I'm not sure it matters very much. And then he anticipates that there are some people who won't want to do that, and they'll be kind of they'll be a kind of, I don't want to say pets, but they'll be, I mean, he has some metaphor for those few people who won't want to live forever. I think he calls them the naturals or something like that.
But there's a derogatory, pathetic.
Why wouldn't they want
yes,
to?
Yes, yes.
And of course, after you do this downloading, I mean, don't forget, you become a lot smarter too, because you're not just downloading the little bit of intellectual equipment you have. You have all of the brilliance of the machine that you get to be enhanced.
You down the version of you that you want.
Right. Exactly. So it's a kind of notion of a kind of transhuman future. And I would have to say that my work is very species chauvinistic. I mean, I'm limiting myself to the human beings who are born, who have the arc of a human life cycle, and who die. And what are our responsibilities to each other as we continue to exist in this form? In that sense, Ray and I operate on, really with a different set of
of morals and values.
The Kevin Kelly is a little bit of a different story, because Kevin and I operate in a little bit more of a parallel, on the same plane. And Kevin called his book What Technology Wants, and I would have to say, and in my deep respect for him, as truly an innovative thinker and writer, I really don't care what technology wants. I care about what people want and what's good for people. And he and I share the belief in a kind of coevolution, in the sense that I begin my book by saying that technology is the architect of our intimacies. I talk over and over about how, I love the Winston Churchill quote, where Winston Churchill says, "We make our buildings, and then our buildings make and shape us." I'm all about the kind of we're in a partnership and we're in a dance with technology where we're influencing each the other. But essentially, my loyalties are to our making and shaping technology to have it conform to our human values and confronting the hard job of figuring out what are those values and how are we going to get technology to do that. Technology wanting is not my...
Well, except I will say this. You refer to it in your book because you're saying let's be cognizant of the fact that we react as if it wants something.
Yes. Yes.
So while you say, I don't care, you don't say you can ignore it.
No, I don't say I can ignore
saying,
it.
You're saying you're not going to decide in its favor, but you've got to take into account that
yes.
we respond
as,
to,
if, yes.
as if technology wants from us.
Yes. But what you mean, but in a way, it's the volitional quality that I don't defer to. For
mm-hmm.
example, now it looks like robots want to love us. Is this something I should then,
yeah.
you know, do I need to take that into account? In what way do I need to take that into account? It now
well,
looks...
I think that you've even said yourself, yeah. I think, that in the way you have to take it into account is to the degree that our vulnerabilities make us susceptible
yes.
to that.
But, you know...
back when they were just programmable keyboards and screens...
Right. There also is the fact that robots want to love us because the field of artificial intelligence has decided to program robots to say they want to love us.
Right. To act as if.
To act yeah. as if they want yeah. to love us.
I'll tell you what I want to make sure
yeah.
is that we get to the other piece, the piece that is the piece about our connectedness. We've talked about it briefly, but some of the things that you talk about is – I'm going to read you a couple of quotes and then let you take off on that. Teenagers avoid making phone calls. They're fearful that they will reveal too much. And when I say this, this is not just your conjecture. The way you work is you think about things, but you do a lot of interviews and you do a lot of observations.
I do the interviews before I think. I really try to do the interviews before I think. I try to think little before I do the interviews.
Very good. Yeah.
I just reverse
no,
the,
that's
right.
Yeah. And so this is based on observation,
yeah.
interview, et cetera. So teenagers avoid making phone calls fearful they will reveal too much. They would rather text than talk. If we don't teach kids how to be alone, they will end up only lonely. You talk about something called the nostalgia of the young, and you say it is for a time that actually maybe never existed. And then one of your biggest findings, I think, because I think it may have surprised you, because you probably did just a little bit of thinking before your interviews, was that parents, it turns out, it's not just the kids who text while they drive, who text all the time, who don't look at you when they're talking to you. They are learning as much of this from their parents as the other way around.
Yeah. I mean, let me just say the texting and the talking. Well, let me start with the parents first. When you do qualitative research, I have two methodological rules. The first one is I don't tell a story unless I have a very, very deep bench. Because if you tell a story that's a kind of idiosyncratic story, there's no resonance in the book. People read the book and say, oh, I haven't seen anything like that, you know. So you tell a story only when you really have many, many stories behind it. I expected to tell a story about teenagers driving their parents crazy with the texting. And instead, I found a story of parents texting while they were driving, texting during dinner, texting with one hand and reading Harry Potter with the other, not looking up. You know,
the one that struck me was they're at the park with a young
yes,
child.
And texting the virtual mistress with
whatever they're doing
yeah.
that you said, how can a child show off?
Yes, the child's on the jungle gym and he's looking down and his father is texting. Or also dads out there, you know, and I'm calling out the dads here because this really was about the dads. Sunday football, you know, that is so many young men talked about Sunday football. Used to be the time when during the commercials or in between plays, that was when my dad used to talk to me. That's when I felt comfortable kind of sharing kind of confidences or whatever, kind of sneaking them
so
in.
So they're already sitting there. Ostensibly they're doing something that isn't intimate.
Yes.
And it allows for
yes.
intimacy.
Yes. And now that time is the time that the dad's on the laptop or the phone.
Wow.
And so
– or else he just TiVos through and that time's gone.
Well, but – or even between plays, really. So
yeah.
So – you know, I think that the issue of parents needing to regroup here and again accept their vulnerability and think again about what it is to be in a family and to set some rules for your family, I think is very, very important. And I'll say here too that I'm optimistic because the parents who I interview who admit to these behaviors are not happy about them really. And I think, again, that when we're not happy about them, I like the phrase vulnerability because when we're not happy about something and we're vulnerable to it, we can do better.
One thing you say, by the way, is, but let's not say we're addicted to it.
Yes, because when you're addicted to heroin, you have one thing you can do, which is to go off the heroin. And we're not going to end up, we're not going to throw away these phones. We're not going to throw away our technology.
So it creates this false choice that leaves me no choice but to keep doing what I'm doing.
And it makes people feel impotent and hopeless. Yeah. So it's better to say you're vulnerable, to face the vulnerability, and really to go back to your values and what's most important. And so that's what I'll say about the parents. On the question of loneliness and teaching your children to be alone, solitude, the kind of solitude that refreshes and restores, is very, very important, not just for children, not just for adolescents, but for all of us. And if you don't teach your children how to be alone, they will only be able to be lonely.
So what you're saying, by the way, is that this 24/7 connection does two things. One, it cheapens connection. And two, it avoids solitude.
Yes. It ultimately leaves you when you're not so frenetically connecting, it doesn't allow you solitude that's restorative. It leaves you lonely. And I like to say that kids have moved from, I have a feeling I want to make a call, to I'd like to have a feeling I need to send a text. In other words, there's a continual need for validation and almost kind of constituting a thought or a feeling by sending it out for votes. Which I don't think is, you know, was really not where you want to be emotionally. And then finally, on the texting and talking, you know, telephone companies are trying to sell you voice plans because they know you're not going to use them. We're hiding from each other. People say that calls aren't efficient. And when you try to bring the value of efficiency into the area of your intimacy, you get yourself into a lot of trouble.
Finally, you say that your headline is people need to strike a balance and some of us are better than others. Many of us are not as good at this as we think we are. 30 seconds, your final word to listeners.
If you're happy, listeners, with where Facebook, the internet, Twitter, your social networking has taken you, I am not the Grinch. Someone called me Sherry Turkle's evil Luddite twin. I'm not that. I enjoy the bounties of this technology. But if you find, if you fear that your life with this is kind of running away with you, you know, read the book, reflect, talk to your family, talk to your friends, and I think we deserve better than some of the places that we've gotten with this technology.
Very good. The book, again, is Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And you can learn more by going to alonetogetherbook.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. You can also at terrencemcnally.net, which is also a world at justmywork.com. You can find transcripts and all sorts of things. If you want to receive my weekly email telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about and a little background, you can either do that at the site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to Devin Jordan, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Check out my show at davidpakman.com. That's David, PAKMAN.com.
We told you the story in February about Duke Energy and the 39,000 tons of toxic coal slurry that gushed into a major North Carolina river. At the time, we also told you that Duke Energy, if they were forced to move out of those areas, said very upfront that they would pass on the costs of the cleanup to their customers. So as usual, the capitalist system works really well for the profits, and then, of course, socializing the social costs and cleanup costs. So now they've cleaned about 3,000 tons worth of the toxic coal slurry, and they've issued a press release saying that the cleanup has been completed. 92%, of course, of the heavy metal-filled and possibly radioactive coal ash is still coating 70 miles of river bottom, and river advocates are understandably frustrated. The argument that Duke Energy is making is that now the stuff has settled and has even been covered by the riverbed, so now you're actually going to further disturb it. If you try to clean it up, you're better off just leaving it there. Of course, actual scientists indicate that just leaving it there is not like undisturbed asbestos, where it's just going to sit unless someone takes a hammer to it, that actually, just because of the currents and because of other weather conditions, this stuff is going to be stirred up. It is going to get, it's going to start flowing. Animals in the river will start eating it, and it will work its way up the food chain. 92% of the coal ash slurry remains, and Duke Energy Lewis says, we're done here.
Incredible. Incredible to think that they could get away with this too. They're just too powerful. Companies like this have too much leverage.
Lewis, don't worry. The free market is going to take care of this because big businesses have the inherent incentive to regulate themselves to make sure that exactly what is happening doesn't happen.
Thank you. That makes perfect sense.
The other thing I was thinking was they want to frack. They want to keep fracking all over the place here. And meanwhile, they still leave 92% of the first disaster not cleaned up and say, let's just not touch it. It's fine. It's covered in sediment. I really trust these companies. I think that they are the people we should listen to.
I think if we were to look at every company like this polluting nationwide, I don't know. I think if we could all see it happening simultaneously and the sheer amount of crap we're getting flooded with, it would probably be sickening, David, nauseating.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and much more, check out our website, davidpakman.com. That's David, PAKMAN.com. And check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/The David Pakman Show.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on Facebook. Like us at facebook.com/Progressive Voices. On the Progressive Voices Facebook page, we update the stories that our hosts like Tom Hartman, Stephanie Miller, Bill Press, and Leslie Marshall will be talking about during their shows. And we share great news, commentaries, opinion pieces, and videos from all over the progressive world. Always progressive, always on. Be part of the progressive conversation. Like us at facebook.com/progressive voices.
The 2016 presidential primaries are a long way off, but look out, for here comes Rick Perry of Texas, riding his state's taxpayer dollars into the GOP primary. Technically, he's not campaigning, yet he's popping up from New York to California, holding press conferences, running TV ads, meeting with money people, and telling everyone how terrific he is. In other words, campaigning. Officially, his cross-country ramble is meant to promote Texas as a corporate utopia that offers state subsidies, zero income taxes, low wages, hands-off regulation, and other cushy deals for corporations that relocate to the Lone Star State. It's a hustle that glorifies Perry, even though he's using Texas tax dollars to take good-paying jobs from the places he visits and turn them into poor-paying jobs in his state. But the governor is used to tapping the public treasury to feather his own nest, and he has recently tapped it again to the tune of $450 an hour. That's for a high-dollar lawyer he's hired at taxpayer expense to try to save his bacon and his presidential fantasies. He doesn't mention it on his out-of-state Praise Perry tour, but he's presently on the brink of being indicted for corruption back home. This mess involves the governor's clumsy attempt to stop an investigation by the state's ethics office into one of his pet slush funds that funnel taxpayer money to his corporate campaign donors. Last year, using a personal lapse by the director of the ethics office as an excuse, Perry simply vetoed the office's entire funding. No office, no investigation, no problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, clever, huh? Except that other funding was made available, so that investigation continues. And then a special prosecutor investigated Perry's ham-handed veto, so now his indictment looms. This could take the wheels off his roadshow.
This is Tara Devlin, a.k.a. Pterodactyl, from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com and the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. If you're an AT&T or Verizon subscriber, you're funding right-wingers. We can ease the damage of money in politics by choosing Credo Mobile. Instead of enabling companies that support Michelle Bachmann and Ted Cruz, make your progressive voice work for a better world. Go to CredoMobile.com/voices. Be part of the Credo Action Network. That's CredoMobile.com/voices. Do it now. We stick together, we win. Stick together, we win. Stick together, we win.